Hello and welcome. I'm Patrick, your host for this presentation in the Inland Mariners audio series. In this interview, I'm talking with Cedric Woodard, former AB on the Great Lakes.
Let me start you way back at the beginning of how you got into sailing.
Well, basically, my dad was a captain, so I had a lot of connections, and I started sailing when I was 17. Between my sophomore and junior year in high school, I sailed the summer vacation. And the first ship I was on was the Peter A.B. Widener. She was built in 1906. And I was a wiper coal passer. U.S. Steel wouldn't let you be a deckhand until you were 18. A lot of fleets wouldn't let you sail till you were 18, but if you were a porter or a coal passer on U.S. Steel, you could start when you're actually 16.
How did you sign up? How did that whole process go for you to become a mariner?
Well, you know, you just go to the Coast Guard station, you get a seaman's card, and then you go to a union hall. There was several unions back when I started. There was SIU and Lake Carriers. And then there's a few smaller ones for the tankers and the cement boats. But the main one was SIU and Lake Carriers, or steel workers, they called it. All the U.S. steel boats were all steel workers. So you go to the union, you put your name down, and eventually they would ship you out.
So where did you sign up? And did you sign up in Duluth?
Yes.
Tell me a little bit about catching your first ship, the Widener.
Well, I was pretty excited because that was my dream. By the time I was 10, all I ever wanted to be was a sailor, so it was pretty exciting to me. The first day I caught in Duluth, and, you know, it wasn't as glamorous. When my dad was captain, I always made trips with him, so I loved that. So actually, working was a lot harder. It was a pretty hard job. You had to shoot the ashes when they were in port. You'd have a ton or two of ashes you'd have to shoot through the ash gun. That was pretty hard physical work. But I was excited to be on the boats, but, you know, after a while, it kind of lost its thrill. It became more work than the thrilling part of just being on the steamboat. That was 1970. I was on the Widener and the Dinky that year. I was a wiper coal passer on both of them, and I sailed a total of about a month. And then I had to go back to school. I was on for relief on both jobs. It was just somebody who was on vacation, and I took their job. So it was, you know, I knew I was only going to be on for 2 weeks.
What was your first trip down the lakes like? Where did you load? Did you load in Duluth?
We loaded in Duluth, and we went to Conneaut, Ohio. When we went to the locks, I think it was like 1 in the morning, I got up to watch us go through the locks, and they all thought I was nuts. I used to love seeing the ships and meeting the ships, and I always enjoyed going through the Sioux locks. But I didn't do that for very long. Well, after a while, you crave sleep, so.
Did they make you go get the keys to the lock, any of that kind of rookie stuff?
No, they didn't pull any pranks on me. I think they knew because my dad was a captain, I'd know better. Because I'd been around ships my whole life. We were sitting at the dock, and the ballast water was coming out of the side tanks because they always punch holes in them. We had a new guy on. He says, "We're taking in water. We should tell somebody." And everybody just ignored him. And he was telling her because everybody knew it was just the holes in the side tanks. But he came after me. He was convinced we were sinking. That was kind of funny.
What was the Elva Dinky like?
You know, the funny thing about the dinky, our cabin was right behind the smokestack. And my porthole, I kept smelling the gas from the smokes. I said, how do people stand this? And it got worse and worse. Well, it wasn't the gas from the smokes. Like, my pillow was on the bunk light, and it melted it. And I was in the doghouse for a week because I stunk up the whole room. There was three of us in this room, and they were too happy with me. Yeah, it was pretty funny, but at the time, they sure weren't happy. And then when I was on the dinky, I was working 6 and 6, so that was pretty hard. I remember we had a fire and boat drill, and I slept through it, and the mate read me the riot act. If you ever do that again, you won't have a job.
How many people bunked to a room on the Widener and on the dinky?
Well, coal passers on the Widener and the dinky were 3 to a room. My room on the Widener was right behind the steering gear. It was right in the fantail, and it was 3 in a room in a small room. And they always had the porthole closed with the cover on it, and it was pitch black in there.
Must have been loud with the steering gear going all the time.
Yeah, it wasn't the best room in the world.
After you got off that summer, then, what were your thoughts after being on the boats for a couple of weeks?
You know, I was anxious to start sailing. It was, you know, all the guys at East High School were jealous of me because I played football my sophomore year. And then my junior year, I went on the boats, and they couldn't believe how much money I made in a short time. And actually, the second engineer on the dinghy says, you don't have to go back to school. You'll make so much money, you'll buy a new car at the end of the year. Why do you need school? And my mother was the only one that led of the 3 brothers, so I was the only one she let sail before high school was over because she figured the other 2 would quit.
So you went back in 71?
In 71, I was a porter on the James E. Ferris. And I sailed 3 months, the whole summer. My brother, he was the wheelsman on the Ferris, and the cook could never get porters. It's a funny story. My dad told me, you never want to be a porter. He says, the cook's always the crabbiest guy on the ship, and the porter takes grief from everybody. And he's couldn't have been more right. That was probably the hardest 3 months of my life.
Really? Being a porter?
It wasn't hard work, but the cook, he was the beer. Before I got on, he went through 22 porters in 3 months. That's how much of a beer he was. That's the only reason I got the job is because he couldn't keep porters. He was a good cook. He was a very good cook, but he was an ex-Marine, and he was the crabbiest guy you ever met. And it didn't help that the captain's daughter became my girlfriend, and the other porter was his nephew, and he wanted his nephew and the captain's daughter to hit it off, so he just played never liked me.
So you were glad to see the end of the door when you left there?
Oh, my goodness. I tell people that was the best and the worst 3 months of my life. It was the best because it was the first time I ever was in love, but it was pretty unbearable putting up with that cook.
Well, how did it go with the captain's daughter?
Well, in the end, she broke my heart. We went together for a year, and we broke up after a year. I was pretty heartbroken.
So that was another summer job on the Ferris. Now, you must be about out of high school by now.
Yeah, the next year I graduate. So my first job after I graduated was a deckhand on the Leon Falk Jr. She was a nice boat. She was 730 feet. They just spent millions of dollars remodeling our room. She had a whole new after end on her. And the rooms were very, very nice.
What was the run for that ship?
She usually went from Superior to Zug Island. Well, we call it the Northern Pacific or Eloise. I don't remember what it was, but so we usually went to the Superior or not to Zug Island. Once in a while, we take a trip to Cleveland, but most trips are always Zug Island. When I was on the Leon Falk, we had a nickel-dime quarter poker game. And I was so lucky, I was making more money in that poker game than I was making in wages. Every night I clean everybody's clock. They call me Mr. Lucky.
So,
I bet you I was making at least $50 every night, and I would just couldn't lose. I played poker on the Buckeye Monitor a little bit, and then they wouldn't let me because I was on the 8 to 12 watch, and I'd come in during my coffee break and get in the game, and I'd clean everybody out in the 15 minutes I had coffee. So they say, you're not coming in here anymore. Those were the only two boats ever. Some of the boats, it was a big game. They played for dollars, and I was too scotch to play for that much money.
This was your first deckhand job then.
Right, right. And the first time I had to try to get a cable to a spile, I couldn't do it. And the mate said to me, Rick, you better eat more Wheaties. You're going to have to build up some muscle. By the time I got off, I could carry a cable almost anywhere. And so I did build up some muscle. The hard part about the Falk, we go to Superior and we'd be in for 4 hours. You'd work the whole time, so you never got home hardly. You know, in the old days, they used to load those boats in about 4 hours. And my first captain on the Falk, he was an old school captain, and I was walking down the deck on the same side. And I said, how is it going? And I didn't know he was even the captain. I just got on, and he grumbled under his breath and gave me a dirty look and kept going. I got up, and they said, don't you know you never go down the same side of the deck as the captain?
He was old school then.
Yeah, he didn't like me being on the deck with him. And the funny thing is, he retired that year. And he was the only captain in National Steel that had his crew walk off on him once. He was a bear. When he retired, probably the funniest thing, me and the other deckhand, I mean, he never talked to the deckhands. He even told the first mate once to go to bed. He was useless. I mean, he was a hard captain. And me and my roommate, we were up in Zug Island, and we're at a traffic light, and it was green, and this car stopped, and this guy got out, and everybody's beeping. And it was the captain. He walked over to us. He said, boys, it was a pleasure sailing with you two fine young men, and shook our hands and got in the car and drove off. And me and the other deckhand both said, did we just dream that? I don't know if he thought he had to be strict, but yeah, we couldn't believe he did that.
Maybe he was just stressed from being on the job for so long. It was
yeah,
time to get out.
I think that could have been part of it. You know, a lot of the companies, they didn't want their captains to associate with the crew. Yeah, that's the way it was for a long time on the lakes.
Was there the big difference between the forward end and the after end?
Oh, yeah. The after end and how most ships in the forward end didn't get along. If you were in the deck department, you didn't associate with the engine department. It was very, very big rivalry on a lot of boats. I could tell you story after story of some of the things made the engineers said about each other. Well, I remember one time the mate in the pilot, so I can't say the lanes, but he called the engine room, and the engineer answered. He said, go F yourself, and hung up. It was rivalry. People in the engine room thought they were the best, you know, they had the better job, and the people on the deck thought you're nuts to work in the engine room. I don't think it's so much that way today because, you know, the new ships, everybody's together in the after end. But in the old ships, you know, the forward end were in the front, the after end were in the back. Even on the Falk, I was in the forward end, but my room was in the after end. The only people on the Falk that slept forward were the wheelsmen and the captain and the mates. So everybody else, the watchmen and the deckhands and the deck watch, all slept in the after end. And the first ship I had with cabins in the forward end was the Buckeye Monitor. And I went on her in 72, and that was like night and day from being on the Leon Falk. The Monitor was 1913, and I was a deckhand, and it was a Steinbrenner boat, and you always carried coal, grain, clinkers, stones, so you're always cleaning cargoes. There was times you'd work 18 hours a day. lot more work, a lot harder job.
How was Steinbrenner to sail for? I've heard good and I've heard bad about them.
Well, the man himself, he was an absolute you-know-what. Nobody, for years, no captain ever retired. He fired them before they had the chance. Yeah, it was like you worked a lot harder. You made big money because you're always working overtime. But as far as Steimer himself, he was a real horse's butt. They skimped on everything. I'd say the only thing they didn't skimp on Steimer when I was there was the food. We ate pretty good. You get on those old boats, the monitor had telescoping hatches, so you tarped them, you batten them. That was a lot of hard physical work. You're always cleaning cargo holds, so that was a lot of work.
Unloading was done with the scoop buckets?
Yeah, with the shoreside cranes.
Yeah.
Same with the Falk. She was a straight decker till the end. I didn't sail on my first self-unloader till, I'm thinking, my first self-unloading job was the Mesabi Miner. I was offered a job on the self-unloader through the union hall, but I turned it down. I said, I don't want a self-unloader. Of course, now everything's pretty much a self-unloader, but...
So, 72, you're on the Buckeye Monitor. Was that the entire year that you were on there then?
Well, I was on the Falk. I started on the Falk, then I went to the Buckeye Monitor, and I ended the season as a porter on the Eugene W. Parney. So I was on three boats in 72.
So you're bouncing around to different fleets then?
Yeah, sailing was good. If somebody looked at you the wrong way, you'd walk off and you could get a job the next day.
Did you ever do that?
Oh, yeah. I quit the Falk, went on the monitor. I quit the Falk mainly because I never got home. And then I quit the monitor because I got mad at somebody and ended up on the Parney. And then the next year I went out on the Chicago Trader in 73 for the whole season. That was the first time I was on a boat from beginning to the end of the season.
So the Chicago Trader, that hauled a lot of grain, if I recall.
Right. We carried grain almost every trip. We went to several different elevators. It wasn't always the same one. When you had the grain scoopers in Buffalo, you could never say anything to them because if you got them mad, they could walk right off the ship. They were a real strong union. And when you unloaded grain, they left. They left a mess. They didn't do a good job. Say you left Buffalo, you usually go to Toledo for a load of coal. You'd be working from the time you left Buffalo prisoner to the time you got to Toledo cleaning cargo holds, and it was a mess. I bet you we shoveled thousands of bushels of grain over the side. They did all they had to do. You could never say anything to them.
Wasn't that mainly a lot of off-duty police and fire members, if I recall?
It was a lot of people that had done it for ages. You had to know somebody. Even in Duluth, you had to know somebody to be on the grain docks. All that was.
Chicago Trader, what was that ship like? Any particular?
Well, she was built in 1911, but she had great tank tops. I don't know when they put the new tank tops, but by the time you're in the fourth hole cleaning up, the first three would already be dry. And on the monitor, you are always puddling. You're always down there after you clean it, sweeping the water and getting it to the pump. So the Trader was in good shape for her age. She was oil-fired. She was brand-new tank tops. She was, in some ways, a good job. On the end of the 73 season, when I got off the Trader, I went on one trip on the Ben Morrell to lay her up. And that was a nightmare. The first day we got into Buffalo, we broke a leg on the grain dock. So instead of having two legs, which they normally unload you, we only had one. So it took 6 days. And I was the day man. That was the deckhand that didn't have a watch. I worked 5 days in a row, 18 hours. And when we got off, the mate said, he said, Rick's the only one who did any work on this boat since the time he's been on here. I went over to Superior. The union hall called me to put on tarps. That's all I was going to do, help them put on tarps. And the mate said, you're a really good worker. What's your name? I said, Rick Woodard. He says, you're a Woodard. He says, Woodards are good workers. He said, how would you like to go to Buffalo? Well, I didn't want to go to Buffalo, but my dad says, actually, on the trailer, I quit 1 week before it laid up. And the mate, they had a new second mate. They fired the captain that trip. And the captain, I went with two captains' daughter. The captain of the Chicago trader, I went with his daughter for 3 years, and they fired him that trip. So they put a new captain on, and their second mate got off sick. They put a new second mate, and he was a real ass. And I quit, and the whole Ford end practically quit. All three deckhands walked off. Some of the watchmen walked off. So my dad said, if you lay up the morale, maybe you'll still get your unemployment, which I didn't, but I did lay it up. She had 36 hatches, and they were the most morphidite hatches you've ever seen. She had to pull each side of the telescoping hatches twice. So she was the hardest boat I ever was on, far as mechanically. And then the next year I went, I got on the morale again in the beginning of the season. I said, I don't want no part of this. So I quit, and I ended up getting on the Thomas Wilson in 74. And that was the best timer boat I ever sailed on.
Was that your first boat with one-piece hatches?
It was the second. The Falcon had one-piece hatches, but yeah. I didn't know how good I had it at the time. You know, I was a green deckhand. I didn't realize how much work a telescoping hatch boat was.
I've heard you'd lose your fingers on those things.
You know, I should have lost my fingers three times. I think the Lord just protected me, because three times I had my fingers caught in the cable, and I should have cut them off just like that, and I got my hand out. I always thank the Lord. I said, he saved my fingers, because every one of them, I should have lost them in a split second. Yeah, the one time I got my fingers out, but my glove was still there in the cable, in the eye of the cable. But yeah, I had a lot of close calls on those boats. It was a dangerous job, really, especially the telescoping hatches. You only had a foot between hatches, and you'd be cleaning, you know, between the hatches to take another cargo, and you'd have stone or coal or slippery drain, and you're walking between them. I mean, it was very dangerous. No safety lines, no nothing. I remember one time I slipped, and I caught myself on the edge of the hatch before I went in, and my watchman turned around and says, Rick, you look like a ghost. What happened? I said, I almost fell in the cargo hole. He says, go take a break. So you had to be careful, and the cables, of course, were dangerous. On the Leon Falk, I had one snap and go right over my head.
Ooh.
Yeah, I was just lucky. I had an old wheelsman, he had a patch over his throat. He couldn't talk. He kind of talked through a machine, and he was motioning and all this. I didn't know what the hell he was trying to tell me. But all of a sudden, the cable snapped. It went right over me. I said to myself, boy, that was close.
So what was the Thomas Wilson like as a ship?
Well, she was a maritime boat. She was built in 1943. She was a really good job. I ended up laying her up that year. That was the first boat that I actually got on and then laid up. I think I was on the trader I was on from the first trip up to the only. I got off with a half a trip to go, but the Wilson I got on in April and got off her later up in December, and then she went to Columbia. Steinbrenner sold her.
So you sailed it the last year as a Steinbrenner boat.
As a Steinbrenner boat, right.
So that was the end of 74?
Yeah. She laid up in Toledo.
Okay.
Well, after the Wilson, I got on the Kinsman Enterprise, which was a good boat, but I I got allergic to grain dust, which had never bothered me before. I think I was on a lot of medication. I think it was the medication, not the grain dust. So after I was only on her one trip, and then I took that year off. And then the next year, in 76, I went to Cleveland Cliffs. The Champlain was my first cliff boat. She was a maritime boat. She was identical to the Thomas Wilson.
What was their run?
Yeah, they usually went from Silver Bay to Cleveland almost every trip. Silver Bay, Cleveland. Go way up to Upper Republic or Lower Republic. So when you're going up the rivers, all the deckhands had tires, and when you come up to rub up against the dock, you drop the tires so you wouldn't do damage. And I remember one time we were all listening to a radio, which we weren't supposed to have, and we weren't paying attention, and we rubbed up against the dock, and the captain came out, and he just screamed at us.
Scratch his paint job.
He wasn't happy with us.
So 76 was a Champlain. You were on that the entire year?
Yeah, I laid her up.
And where did they lay up? At Toledo again, or?
I think the Champlain laid up in Toledo. It was next year on the Cadillac we laid up in Surgeon Bay. I was on the Champlain, and then the next year I went to the Cadillac, and I was on her 2 years in a row.
So you've got some seniority, finally, to hold a ship. Is that
right? Yeah.
So you're almost 10 years into sailing then at this point?
Yeah, I think the last year in Cliffs was 78.
So did you reach a point where you decided you were going to stay out there and make a career out of this?
You know, the year after the Cadillac, I went to Inner Lake and I decided I was going to finally buckle down and make something of myself. And I got on the Mesabi Minor in the first make. He was hated in Inner Lake. He was a nutcase. And I ended up almost getting killed, and I told him to go F himself. And he fired me, and I just never had the heart for it after that. I sailed, but every boat I swore was my last. Inner Lake still took me, not to brag on myself, but Inner Lake told me I got the best recommendation they'd ever had. So I was well-liked as a crew member. People really liked me. And Inner Lake told me I had the best recommendations they've ever gotten. I laid up the Mothy. I didn't lay her up. I laid up her engine room. And they liked me so much, they called me back the next year to sail for them. And I didn't have my AB ticket yet. And the captain, I was on the Sherwin, and the captain of the Sherwin was a good friend of my father's. And he said, "Rick, why don't you have your AB ticket?" Well, the funny thing is, my brother tried to get his ABs for years and flunked it. And then I talked to him about it. I had a book, and he got his AB ticket. And the guy in the Coast Guard said, "How did you finally get it?" He says, "I learned it all from my brother." So I went the next day, and they had a brand new test. They had changed the AB test on the Great Lakes. And I was the first one to flunk it. And the guy in the Coast Guard says, "Rick, I feel real bad because I know your brother got the old test and you're the only reason he got it," he says. He says, "but whenever you want to retake it, you can take it because you're supposed to wait 30 days. Well, I was pretty down, and then I went to AB school in Cleveland when I was in Cliffs. And we went to the school, and we had the old test, and I got the highest grade of anybody in the whole class, which was around 30 people. So they had me take it again the first, and I flunked it again. So I at that point, was never going to try again. I just said, I can't pass it." And the captain of the Sherwin, he said to me, Leonard Olson, he says, "We're going to go take that test." I thought, good, I'll make an ass of myself again. I didn't want it. And I was on there with them. We were on the Beagle at this time. She had run aground and it hit the little pier, so they were doing a lot of work on her in the shipyard. And one day out of the blue, he says, "We're going to go take that AB test." I thought, oh, my God, I'm going to make an ass out of myself again. And I did pass it that time. And the Coast Guard guy says, Rick, you're the first one to flunk it, and you're the first one to pass it. Nobody could pass that test. It was all salt water. It had nothing to do with the leaks. I think that was a God thing, too. I was just playing to God. If I'm ever going to pass, it's going to be you, Lord, not me.
Funny. So your first ship with Interlake was the Bigley, then?
The first job I had was laying up the engine room of the Mothy.
Okay.
From the Mothy, they called me, and I went on to Sherwin. And she left the pier. I was just bringing her to Sturgeon Bay because they needed a lot of work on her. She had run aground in the St. Mary's River. Both the Bigley and the Sherwin had ripped their bottoms out, so they both needed extensive work. So I brought the Sherwin, and I was in the engine room of the Sherwin. I brought her down to Sturgeon Bay, and then the funny thing, the captain was a good friend of my dad, and the whole four-man crew was supposed to go to the Bigley once they got to Sherwin in Sturgeon Bay, and they were going to go fit out the Bigley. So I was in the engine room, and I was hating the engine room job. And all of a sudden, the engineer says, the captain wants to talk to you. And all these deck guys are giving me a hard time about going back to Superior to fit out the Bigley, and I had to stay in Sturgeon Bay. And I went up to the captain. He says, Rick, how would you like to go to Superior with me? I said, I'd love it, Cap. And the funny thing is, me and the captain were the only one who went. The rest of the crew had to stay there. So that was kind of ironic. I drove him up to Duluth, and then when I was on the Bigley, that's when he got me my AB ticket.
Who was this captain?
Leonard Olson. He was the top captain for Interlake for a lot of years. He was a really nice man.
Who was the captain on the Mesabi Minor that fired you?
Well, he was a good man. He didn't even know what was going on. And I can't remember his name. But the funny thing, the captain on the Mesabi Minor, when I gave up sailing and gave tours on the Irvin, I gave him a tour on the Irvin, and he didn't realize who I was. And at the end of the tour, he says, boy, you know your stuff. That was an excellent tour. That's the best tour I've ever had. And he didn't realize that I'm the guy he fired, but he really didn't fire me. It was the mate. I can't remember his name, but he was a good guy. He was really well-liked. He would have never fired me if he would have known me. And Interlake hired me back. After the minor, I went on the, what did I go on? I was on a bunch of Interlake boats. I sailed on more of their boats than any other company. I was on the Mothy, the Sherwin, the Hoyt, James R. Barker. But after the minor, I just never had the heart. Just never really wanted to make it a career anymore. But they liked me. They kept taking me back. Every time I needed a job, they'd take me back.
So when did you really quit sailing?
Well, the last time I sailed, I was a tour guide on the Irvin, and I was, for ego, I wanted to see if I could still ship out. So I went up to the U.S. Steel office and asked them if they needed ABs, and they put me out 3 days later. And that was the Callaway, and that was my last boat. That was 1990. Callaway was my last boat, and I was only on her for about 2 weeks, and I just didn't want to do it. I was married then, and I wanted no part of sailing. We went from Duluth to Lorraine, and then we took a load of stone to Detroit, and then we came up to Duluth, and I got off. My wife wasn't happy with me at the time. She just thought I should have tried it a little longer, but I just didn't want to do it. I think one of the reasons I quit sailing, I got bipolar when I was 20 years old, so I had medical issues too. It was a lot of stress on me. So I've been good for 37 years now. As long as I'm on my medication, I've always been good. But a couple of those boats, my dad wanted me to get back on the lakes, and I was not ready to sail. I remember being on the Elton Hoyt II, and I didn't sleep for 8 days. Yeah, That's a funny story. I pray to the Lord every night, Lord, get me off this boat without quitting. If I quit, I can never face my father, but get me off this boat. And we hit a bridge in Chicago, and I just said, thank you, Lord.
Well, let's talk a little bit about your family that sailed.
Yeah, my dad was started when he was 14 on the old wooden lumber hookers. He actually sailed on a working schooner, the Our Son. The lumber hookers used to pull the Our Son, and she was actually a working schooner. And according to Pat Laverty, my dad's the only man to work on a wooden working vessel on the lakes and ended up sailing on a 1,000-footer before he retired. He went out, his friend was the captain on the Prescott, and he went out third mate on the Prescott with him a couple of trips to help him out. That's when he was a pilot at the time.
And your father's name is what?
Same as mine, Cedric.
Okay.
I was named after my dad. That's a story I could tell you that you get a laugh out of.
Okay, let's hear it.
I'm the youngest. There's three boys in my family. When my oldest brother is born, my dad was home at the time, and my mother says, I'm naming him Cedric. And my dad says, I never liked Cedric. Don't name him Cedric. So 5 years later, when my second brother was born, my dad was home at the time, and my mother says, I'm naming him Cedric. He says, I don't like Cedric. So when I was born, my dad was in Lake Michigan. He had no say. I got Cedric.
Okay. So what year was this that he started sailing?
Well, he was born in 1908, and he started when he was 14. So what would it be, 22?
22, yeah.
And the last night he ever sailed was the night the Fitzgerald went down. He had a stroke that winter, and he never sailed again.
Take me back further to his old lumber hooker. He worked on lumber hookers out of Duluth Superior?
No, that would have been, he was from Michigan. He lived in the Upper Vista in Michigan. He didn't move to Duluth until he became a captain. He moved to Duluth because that's where the ships went most of the time. He wanted to be around his family as much as possible. And I think the first year he actually got to be captain was the year I was born in 53.
So he was around for a long time before he got to be a captain.
Yeah. He was on a lot of the old Hutchinson boats, and then, you know, Hutchinson was Buckeye and Pioneer. And in 61, Pioneer went out of business. The only one left was Buckeye, and they only had three ships sailing at the time. So he went virtually from captain to third mate. So that year he went piloting, and then the next year he went back to Buckeye, and eventually, he got to be the head captain of Buckeye, and then they sold to Steinbrenner, and he went piloting.
How did he like piloting?
He liked it. He liked it a lot. He said there's a lot less pressure. If you got around somebody you didn't like, you only had them for a day. When he was captain, they put a lot of the guys they didn't trust much because he was their best captain, and they figured he could handle anybody, but there was, you know, a lot of alcohol on the boats. There was a lot of guys you really had to watch. And my dad was never really a drinker, so that was another reason Hutch liked him so much. My dad told me, Hutch told my dad he was the best captain Hutch ever had, so he was well-liked by everybody.
He was out in this storm, the Fitzgerald storm. I'm sure you've been probably asked about that a bazillion times.
Yeah, you know, him and the captain, well, that night when they went out, my dad said to the captain, he says, we got no business going out tonight. It's way, way too rough. And the captain laughed at him and said, pilot, these are only lakes. We got nothing to worry about. So my dad says, well, if you want to go out, we'll go out. It actually, that storm was so bad, it took him 8 hours to go 11 miles. He said at one point, he said they weren't even making headway. And that was the smallest ship in this storm. That was only a 465-foot saltwater ship, and it was in ballast, and they almost rolled over that night. Yeah, she was real small. Yeah, my dad never knew the fit sink until hours later. You know, when you're on the ship, you monitor channel 16, and the last time he talked to the skipper of the fit, they never switched the radio back to 16, so he never got any of the emergency calls that she had gone down. They didn't switch the radio back until he came up in the pilot house around 10 o'clock that night. There was three saltwater ships out there that night, and my dad was the leading ship. There was the Namfre and the Bemfre behind them, and they were big ships. They were 730 feet long, and they had a lot of power. But my dad said him and the captain, they saw the lights of the fits, and then there was this snow squall, and then it cleared, and she was gone, and never dreaming. They both said, where in the world did that ship go? Never dreaming she actually sunk. You know, he told them the Coast Guard inquiry, they weren't sure if it was actual lights, but he thought it was a ship, but he said it could have been, you know, light, just the lighting. But he told me he thought it was the Fitz. Captain of the Fitz called them wanting to know if the radio beacon was working in Whitefish Point, and it was out that night, and the captain told them both his radars were out, so... So the Fitz had no clue where he was, and my dad always believed she hit the reef. Most of the sailors on the lakes all believe that. They don't think she broke when she hit. She just punched a hole, and she was taking in so much water that she went down like a rock. McSorley always figured he'd make it to Whitefish Point, but he just never got there.
What's the biggest misconception that people have about people who sail?
Oh, boy, I don't know. I think people think you just sit on the boat and you never work. They think you ride it up and down the lakes and it's an easy job. They don't realize how much actual work you do. You know, especially today, they cut the crews on all these boats. You know, when I first sailed, there was three deckhands, three deck watch, three watchmen, three wheelsmen, and you'd have three co-passers, three firemen, three oilers, and all those jobs have been cut, most of them. No, I'd never want to sail anymore. Now, as a kid, that's all I ever wanted to do, and I still love ships. I'm a ship nut, but I have no desire to work on a boat anymore. I'd like to make a trip someday. That would be fun.
This concludes this Inland Mariner's audio interview. Thank you for listening. This audio program has been presented by the Inland Mariners, Cypress Pictures LLC, and Patrick Lipinski. To hear more, go to inlandmariners.com.